Good morning. On today's programme, life for displaced Palestinians in Lebanon and the challenge to Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro. But first to Ukraine and the underground bunkers where people seek shelter from Russian bombs and missiles targeted at Ukrainian cities. With dozens of air raid sirens every day, the bunkers have become familiar gathering places for Ukrainian men, women and children seeking protection, as Emmanuel Chaz now reports from Lviv.
It's past midnight in Lviv when airstrike alarms break the silence of the night once again. The second alert tonight. Outside, the sirens resonate all over the city. In the hotel, the tired, neutral voice of the receptionist resounds in every room. Alert, alert, please immediately proceed to the bunker. The warning app on my phone echoes the sirens. You can hear people in the corridor already making their way underground. I lie in bed. It's my first night in Ukraine. I have never experienced living under the threat of airstrikes. I know already that we have between 10 and 30 minutes to reach safety, depending on where the missiles are launched from. Enough time to get dressed, not that it matters, but still, I don't want to go to the bunker in my pyjamas. I get up, hastily put on the first clothes I can put my hands on, decide against taking my purse, remembering the safety instructions heard dozens of times in planes. In case of emergency, do not take any luggage with you. I do bring my sleeping bag, though. You never know how long an alarm can last, and head underground. In the stairs, I meet a few other residents, all looking tired, but none panicking. 2 months into the war, sheltering from airstrikes has already become a routine for them. Our bunker is a maze of modern, concrete-built corridors and a few spaces with all amenities. There is a kitchen, a bathroom, a few mattresses thrown here and there, some benches, and plenty of chairs. It's late, and none of them seem particularly appealing. I spot an empty corner on the floor and sit down, but I don't have time to unfold my sleeping bag. A group of 5 female students arrive, all already wrapped in their covers, and they tell me they're sorry, but this is their spot, could I please leave? I'm too amused by the absurdity of it to be crossed, and I will understand in the weeks to come that indeed, in bunkers too, people develop habits and don't like to change them. I move to another part of the bunker, catching up with my 2 Ukrainian colleagues. Mykola greets me with a tired smile, and Volodymyr with a sarcastic, "Welcome to Ukraine." They ask if I want a cup of tea and whether I have brought my passport. I left it in the room. I'm advised to bring it next time, as it can serve as identification in case I'm under the rubble after an airstrike. They're already lying on the floor, ready to sleep behind 2 paper recycling bins on one side and a thick concrete recess on the other. "Wanna sleep here?" they ask. I really don't. I choose an empty bench near them instead. People keep on arriving. There's this little boy with puffy eyes and still wrapped into his duvet, who struggles to put one foot in front of the other because he's so tired, gently pushed by his parents who make their way through a dimly lit part of the bunker. Other parents follow their little girl, a toddler who fortunately doesn't realize what's going on and smiles gently at everyone. From her perspective, all of this is like going on an adventure. There's also that group of medics from some foreign NGOs. They're joking around loudly, sharing their experiences from the front line, and then there's those 2 pale, middle-aged women sitting together, still wearing their duffel coats and clutching onto their handbags on their lap. They look straight into the wall in front of them, as if in a state of shock. They look like they've seen hell, and they probably have, because so many of the people here tonight have escaped exactly that from the areas of the country worst affected by the war. I tweeted about the alarm and answered the messages sent by worried friends. After a very long while, all phones start to ring again. With a reassuring, calm bell, the warning app informs us that the alarm is over. At the same time, the receptionist's voice resounds through the loudspeakers. Everybody may now go back to their rooms. There's a palpable sense of relief among us, and we make our way upstairs. This time, the Ukrainian air defense system worked well. There was no strike over Lviv. Only a few hours later, however, in the early morning, we all back into the bunker. As we sat in silence once again, a woman from the neighborhood arrives, seeking shelter too. She's clearly distraught and cries when she loudly announces, "I've seen the rockets, they're hitting Lviv." Volodymyr rolls his eyes and tells me, "She's going to panic everyone else." People come over to comfort the woman, who gets quieter as she's urged not to scare the children. In the meantime, we quickly find out about the strikes on social media. 4 missiles have fallen onto Lviv, despite authorities asking people not to share pictures as it can be used by the aggressor to find out whether or not the strikes were successful. Videos of the missiles already circulate. Western Ukraine had, up until that day, been relatively spared the atrocities we've seen unfolding in the central and eastern parts of the country. But on my first day in Ukraine, those strikes killed 7 people at a car service station and injured another 13, with Russia maintaining it doesn't target civilians. On that day, among the injured, though, was a 3-year-old boy whose parents had fled from Donbass into the West to bring their child to safety. This family is part of over 6 million refugees and 7 million internally displaced Ukrainians who fled their homes to escape the war. But in Ukraine, nowhere feels safe anymore. Emmanuel Shaz in Ukraine for RTE World Report.
To the Middle East next, and today Palestinians will mark al-Nakba, the term used for the destruction of Palestinian society in 1948 during Israel's War of Independence. Today, thousands of displaced Palestinians in Lebanon continue to feel the effects of being expelled from their homeland, as Hannah McCarthy reports now from Beirut.
May is the month where Palestinians remember al-Nakba, an Arabic term for the catastrophe. Al-Nakba refers to the forced expulsion of Palestinians from their homes during Israel's War of Independence at the end of the 1940s. Thousands were killed, and whole villages were scattered across Gaza and the West Bank, as well as in neighbouring Lebanon, Syria and Jordan. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, many who had once fished in the sea around Haifa or farmed land around Nazareth, moved into camps established by UNRWA, the UN agency that was given a mandate to look after Palestinian refugees and preserve their right of return. Today, UNRWA provides healthcare, education and other services to 5.7 million Palestinians across the Middle East. Over 2 million are in Jordan, where most have now been granted citizenship, except for 140,000 who first went to Gaza in 1948 before fleeing to Jordan in 1967. This group of Palestinian refugees are denied basic services from the Jordanian government and rely solely on UNRWA. Before the Syrian war erupted in 2011, over 500,000 Palestinian refugees lived in Syria. Around a fifth of these refugees have left the country since the conflict began, with many moving to UNRWA camps in neighbouring countries. Lebanon initially welcomed the Palestinians who fled there after al-Nakba. In the 1950s, the government of Kamil Shimon offered citizenship to mostly educated Christian Palestinians, as well as to wealthy Muslim Palestinians. Since then, and the civil war which raged through Lebanon from 1975 to 1990, the country has become a much more hostile place for Palestinians. Today, laws reinforce segregation between Palestinians and the rest of Lebanese society. Since 2001, Palestinians have been barred from owning property in Lebanon, which means that they have few opportunities to leave the overcrowded refugee camps where they're forced to go through checkpoints whenever they leave and enter. Repairs and construction at these camps are slow, as Palestinians require the consent of the Lebanese army for any building work, no matter how small. Palestinians are also barred from working in most professions in Lebanon. They can study medicine or engineering or law, but they'll never be able to properly become lawyers or engineers or doctors. They're often limited to working for UNRWA itself, or else they must partner with Lebanese professionals who can sign their paperwork. A Palestinian doctor in Lebanon can legally only really work as an assistant for a Lebanese doctor. The job restrictions have kept Palestinian families in a cycle of poverty, with few opportunities to improve their circumstances in Lebanon. Palestinians are heavily reliant on the overstretched UNRWA for basic services. The resources available to the UN agency have stagnated over the last decade, while the needs of Palestinian refugees have kept increasing. During the Trump administration, which aligned itself closely with Israel, US funding for UNRWA effectively ceased. Jared Kushner, Trump's advisor and son-in-law, also lobbied Jordan to remove the refugee status of Palestinians living there. It would, of course, be convenient for Israel if Palestinian refugees simply became Jordanians instead. While the Biden administration has reinstated US funding for the beleaguered UN agency, it has not returned to pre-Trump levels. Last month, the head of UNRWA proposed that due to the scale of the funding crisis and a clear deprioritization of the Palestinian issue, that some services would be delegated to other UN agencies. Samir Sanajlawi, an expert on Palestinian humanitarian affairs, says that this proposal is intended to test the waters ahead of a UN vote on renewing UNRWA's mandate next year. He says that it also gives a green light to countries that have been trying to manipulate this mandate and gradually end the work of UNRWA. Israel has long campaigned for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees to be disbanded and for other UN agencies to deliver services instead. This is because UNRWA is not just a humanitarian organisation. It's a political statement and a reminder that the international community, which facilitated and stood by as al-Nakba happened, has a responsibility to solve this generational catastrophe for the Palestinian people. For World Report, I'm Hannah McCarthy in Beirut.
Finally, we go to Brazil, and that country's former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has launched his candidacy to unseat far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro in elections due to be held this October. But improving living standards for Brazilians will be an uphill task, as Sam Cowie reports now from Sao Paulo.
An acoustic rendition of Brazil's national anthem, complete with sublime vocals from singer Tereza Cristina, rang out through the Sao Paulo Convention Centre. On stage, dozens of the country's most high-profile political figures sang along. Draped across one of the loudspeakers was a flag of Sport Club Corinthians Paulista, Sao Paulo's most popular football team. It is also the team of the man at the centre of the stage, two-time former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who is set to launch a record sixth bid to lead Brazil. In 2003, when I took office as President of the Republic, I said that if, at the end of my term, all Brazilians had at least the possibility to have breakfast, lunch and dinner, I would have fulfilled the mission of my life, he said. We fought the greatest of all battles against hunger and we won. But today, I know that I need to fulfill the same mission again. Now 76, Lula finds his political comeback amid rocketing living costs and growing hunger in Latin America's largest democracy. Lula left the Brazilian presidency at the end of 2010 with an 85% approval rating after tens of millions of Brazilians were lifted out of poverty after a remarkable period of sustainable growth and social inclusion. Brazil, the South American giant of 210 million people, the last country to abolish slavery, and one of the world's most violent and unequal countries, had long been derided as the country of the future, and it always will be. And when Lula left the presidency in 2010, having elected Brazil's first female president, Dilma Rousseff, as his successor, with a booming economy, for many Brazilians, the future had finally arrived. But 5 years later, during Rousseff's second mandate, Brazil fell into its worst recession in modern history. She was later impeached, and Lula was jailed on controversial corruption charges that were later annulled by Brazil's Supreme Court. Today, more than half of the population suffers some kind of food insecurity, according to studies, with reports of people queuing at butcher shops for donations of bones making national headlines. Under the watch of far-right incumbent President Jair Bolsonaro, at least 660,000 Brazilians died of COVID-19. If elected, Lula will face significant challenges to tackle immediate poverty concerns while battling inflation and delivering growth to generate jobs. Governability will also be an issue. Lula chose centre-right former Sao Paulo governor, his 2006 elections rival, Geraldo Alckmin, to be his vice president. The move was considered a pragmatic attempt to get the country's political centre and business community on side. Meanwhile, the spectre of some kind of authoritarian power grab looms large in Brazil, a country that endured a brutal 21-year military dictatorship. Bolsonaro is an outspoken admirer of the military regime and looks up to autocratic leaders like Viktor Orban in Hungary. He has repeatedly claimed that Brazil's electronic voting system is vulnerable to fraud, setting the stage for a potential crisis when the votes are counted. On a 0-10 scale of Bolsonaro gracefully accepting the election results if he loses, the chances are at 1 or 2, said Thomas Trauman, a political analyst and former communications minister for Lula's Workers' Party. The election is still more than 5 months away and Lula continues to lead opinion polls by a relatively comfortable margin, although it is expected that his lead will shrink as the elections get closer. For World Report in Sao Paulo, I'm Sam Cowie.
Well, that's our lot for today. You can listen back to the programme on rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, for myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.